And we're back with the Sports Medicine Broadcast. You can look us up at www.sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. And this episode will be with Roland Ramirez. So we will do www.sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/Roland Ramirez 2016. I have in my notes first name, last name. So I literally was just about to read. First name, last name. It's been a long day, man. My brain is just not
functioning.
Nope. I've been up since 4:30 in the morning working. And
nice.
You know, it is what it is. So I am Dr. Josh Yellen, Program Director, University of Houston, Master of Athletic Training Program. And we are here. I am co-hosting. I have the privilege of co-hosting the Sports Medicine Broadcast with Jeremy Jackson. And so I have tried to take over his show, but he keeps coming back in. And, well, we're just going to have to be friends for a little bit. So we're here with Roland Ramirez. To my left is Jameer Marina, second-year MAT student. With the University of Houston Master of Athletic Training Program. Roland, your talk is about core injuries in the athlete.
Right.
And so whenever I'm teaching anatomy, right, the first thing that I start off with is this theory of ontogeny recapitulating phylogeny. Right?
Yeah. And it's, sure.
Yeah. And it,
whatever
and it's,
you said.
Yeah, and it's this theory of, right, at some point we were quadrupedal mammals and you know, we begin to erect, and now we're bipedal mammals. And if you understand how the human skeleton is built, right, the femur looks like the humerus, the tibia looks like the ulna, the radius looks like the fibula, you know, so on. Mm-hmm. You know, if I've got my carpals, I got my it all looks alike. And if I look and if I compare our mammalian skeleton to other mammalian skeletons, like for instance, a whale, right, if you ever look at how a whale swims through the water, mm-hmm. that tail moves differently than a fish or a shark. Right. And so if I were to take off the whale skeleton, it looks like a human being. You know, if I look at it, it looks like the human being with its heels side to side. Right. And that's the tail fin of the whale. That's why it moves up and down. So based on that, boom, dropping knowledge. Let's talk about core stability. Right. And let's talk about some of the major issues. We've kind of revolved a little bit around this. Brian Duncan was in here before talking about sacroiliac dysfunction.
Right.
Chris Juno was in here, you know, about dry needling, talking about hitting the multifidi. So let's talk about core stability.
Right.
Right.
Okay. You know, I'll start by saying this. I mean, the core musculature and pelvic area is just so complex. Very complex and sometimes hard to understand, and that's what I tried to talk about in my presentation. In there is really listening in for the history on these types of athletic pubalgia injuries, but also understanding the anatomy and the core stability that needs to be regained and retrained in this whole process. When you're talking about, you know, grade 3 adductor strains and tears and muscles avulsing from, you know, the pelvis, they can, one issue can lead to another, and you're having to reattach certain muscles to other tendons or to the pelvis itself. And so your pelvic and core stability can be compromised. And so we have to, as rehab professionals, understand the anatomy. We have to understand the surgical procedure if surgery is what is warranted. Mm-hmm. And then we have to be able to progress our athletes or our patients in a way that is safe and effective and try to reestablish a stability for them to function and return to sport.
Mm-hmm. And so for all those that are listening and tuning into this live or will watch it later, Roland is an athletic trainer with the Houston Texans and is duly credentialed PTAT and is the director of rehabilitation for the Houston Texans. Mm-hmm. And does a phenomenal job with us. We're very fortunate to have him as one of our preceptors. And I'm so happy that he's committed to come talk to our program about whatever he wants to talk about. And so talk to the audience here a little bit about going back to the core stability. We know that it's complex. Do we look at it internal to external to internal? Do I really start looking at the joints? Do I look at iliopsoas, transverse. Right. Walk us through this algorithm that you've got.
Sure. I think you have to do a little bit of both, honestly. And it starts with listening in to the history and to their exam, you know, or the history guiding your exam. A lot of the guys will come in and say that they've had lower abdominal pain for years, all through college, that they, once they warm up, they feel fine and they're able to function. But they still are bothered with certain movements or exercises, and it takes them a little bit to warm up. And then once they warm up, it's fine. Or there's pain with coughing and sneezing and kicking or with excessive force or cutting, you know. So it just depends on what it is. And then in other cases, you have a traumatic event where they felt a huge pop and they can't hardly walk. Mm-hmm. And so there's different there can be some injuries that are overuse and can gradually kind of an insidious onset, or you can have some that are very traumatic. Mm-hmm. And so you have to kind of filter through all of that, filter through their history, and then let that guide your exam. And I think that you have to rule out hip pathology. You have to, any kind of intra-abdominal pressure, whether it's lower abdominal muscles you're looking at or hip musculature or, you know, adductors, really listening in to what their symptoms are and what exacerbates those symptoms, and then let that guide your exam and try to figure things out. And in other severe cases, you might have to refer to an MRI to help you out and really diagnose things. You might find some hip pathology as well, and then decide whether it's really coming from your hip or if it's really coming from something else. And you know, you might have to send them to a specialist that understands that a little more. It can be, because of the complexity of these injuries, it can be very frustrating, very hard to diagnose. And so sometimes you have to refer them on. But when you've seen a few more and more, you kind of know how these present, and then able to differentiate, you know, different structures that are involved.
Mm-hmm. And so one of the questions I always think about is, in your particular setting, obviously, you know, working with football, but you are working with a very specific population. These are professional football players. Mm-hmm. And boy, every time I'm at the Houston Texans facility, it seems like these human beings are just getting bigger and bigger and faster and stronger. Mm-hmm. And the bodies are just impressive.
Right.
And so with that, you know, obviously, I think the average age of your patient population has got to be probably 23 years old.
And, yes, sir.
And they are...
They're massive.
Yeah, they are massive and they are strong. And we know structurally that their bones aren't totally developed yet. And they've got all of this force, you know, pulling on the tendons and pulling on the ligaments. So is there one set of pathologies, you know, when it comes to core, that you see more than others?
You know, that's a great question.
I've asked a lot of good questions today.
Yeah, that's a great question.
That's a doctoral degree.
We've had a lot of injuries, you know, in our setting because of the size and speed and power of these individuals and these players. Our injuries tend to be traumatic. Mm-hmm. I mean, these guys are in multiple car wrecks just about every weekend. And it's not just from the collisions. It's also from, it's one thing to explode and cut and twist and turn off of one leg, but then you're having to fight against another 200 or 300 pound guy that jerks you one way, and you're trying to go in an opposite direction. And so the forces around their extremities and their pelvis is, I mean, just exponential. Mm-hmm. And that it's very difficult. I mean, most of them are traumatic, but a lot of them are overuse. There are times where lower abdominal tears, they've had this vague burning pain for a while. They can still perform at a high level. But then after the season, we send them to a specialist. They go in, and sure enough, they have, you know, maybe half or a third of their lower abdominal is gone. And so they're having to reattach it to the pelvis.
Still attached.
Still attached, but maybe some portion of it is detached,
right?
You know, or avulsed, and so they're having to do that, or they might find, you know, some adductor, portions of the adductor are affected, and so they're able to function at a very high level, but they need some reinforcement. and to alleviate some of that pain. And then there's, you know, you have the other ones that feel their pop. They can hardly walk. Mm-hmm. That you feel the huge, you know, the bulge in their groin. Mm-hmm. That just avulsed. They had a grade 3 avulsion of their adductor. Right. You know, so some are very obvious and some are not so
and,
much.
And so going back to the core, you know, when you're really looking at, you know, you've got a college athlete that makes a transition from college to pro, or you've got a pro athlete that is, you know, in their, you know, 8th year, 5th year, whatever it is. What type of exercises are you really wanting to focus on to really make sure that, you know what, everybody on the team is going to do these 3 things?
Right. Again, great question. you know,
I'm just saying.
I think the core stability exercises are more than just leg raises and crunches.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the importance lies in us trying to be as thorough and also as safe and creative as we can, whether that's, you know, anti-rotational type exercises with pulley systems, whether that's manual perturbations as they're, you know, squeezing on a ball between their knees or have their feet up on a step and they're on a stability ball and we're doing manual perturbations or, mm-hmm. you know, some kind of long-term, long-duration type core stability as opposed to, you know, saying, hey, hit this many crunches or this many straight leg raises or use this ball and do this. You know, I think that we can get more involved. I don't have 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 exercises that are my go-tos. You know, every individual is slightly different and you have to start in a slow, controlled fashion and then progress from there.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on the severity of the injury and what was repaired, you eventually get into exercises that are all inclusive. And the core stability in general has got to be challenging, especially at the level of play that our guys are at, and then incorporating all their position stuff. You know, you might get them into a linebacker stance. You might get them into a crouch position and as a lineman and doing perturbations that way, mm-hmm. you know, as they're in the middle of a kick slide or something. So we try to be creative. We try to be as challenging as we can. I don't have many go-tos. But I just try to be thorough with everything that we do.
Is there?
I'll say in the presentation there are a whole list of videos, and that's a really big presentation. So I was actually having trouble uploading it onto my drive, but I'm gonna get it uploaded.
Roland said he's gonna demonstrate now.
Demonstrate all of them.
Yeah.
And so you kind of walk through a progression with one of your athletes,
mm-hmm.
of the basic stuff, and then just like you said. You know, you're individualizing it. So there's a whole lot of different exercises on there. And I know normally you mention it and you put it out in there, but if someone wants to get a hold of you, how are they going to do that?
They can either, you know, they can email me, which I had up there. So Roland.Ramirez, RAMIREZ at HoustonTexans.com. Or you know, Twitter is another way. So at RO, and then _ entrenador, which we talked about before. So ENTREN. ADOR. Okay.
Which means what?
Which means athletic trainer or trainer or coach, but mm-hmm. RO_entrenador. Mm-hmm. That's just to show my Spanish side as well.
So that's just he has a really good presentation set up showing those exercises, like you're asking. Go to exercises. He said he doesn't have any 1 or 2, but there is a very good progression in that presentation, which I hope to have uploaded and easily accessible at sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/RolandRamirez2016.
First name, last name.
Perfect. So I can just refer them to your website if you're going to
exactly
upload
right.
it. That's going to be the easiest thing.
That's the plan.
Yeah. All right.
That's exactly
that works.
Right. So let me go back to, I know you don't have a specific set of exercises. You know, like when we were talking to some other people, they like to do these 3 exercises.
Mm-hmm.
And you more individualized. Theoretically, though, are you more of a slow twitch to fast twitch guy? Are you more of a fast twitch to slow twitch guy? Are you more of a combination? So what I mean to those that are listening is that would you start off with more slow twitch exercises, stabilization, more isometric, and move into more explosive isotonic? Or, you know, how do you kind of progress? There's got to be some theoretical platform that you use.
Right. And I think it I'm definitely a slow twitch, slow controlled, short lever type exercises, meaning you're not going to have a ball over their head week one, mm-hmm. and you have them there, you know, extend their arms and their legs all the way out to opposite walls. You're mm-hmm. just not going to do that. They're going to stand up and punch you in the face.
Mm-hmm.
These are big people. So you don't want that. And so you have to start small. You have to start slow. You have to start controlled. And as they progress, then you can start elongating tissues, getting into a few more challenging exercises with a stability ball. Then kettlebells overhead, mm-hmm. leg lowering type exercises. And then eventually there might be kind of a hybrid of maybe in that middle stage of where you're doing some slow and controlled exercises to warm up, mm-hmm. To get their core going, and then finish off with more challenging, more explosive exercises, plyometric stuff, as you're trying to advance them to return to the field and really progress their running. There are a lot of times where I'm having to, even if it's in the pool, I'm having to apply a lot of strength and conditioning principles, mm-hmm. Which is what I enjoy doing, and being able to work on skips and work on hopping in the pool, using that resistance, working on some explosive type activities to be able to transition over to the field. And once we get onto the field, I mean, running is a plyometric exercise, and so we need to prepare our athletes that way. And so in that middle stage, I try to really use more of a hybrid approach and really use some plyometric things towards the end, and then I get more explosive as we move down the road and really try to advance them and kick their tail as much as I can, as because mm-hmm. these guys are going to face some high forces, and I can never simulate the forces that they will see on the field, right. even at practice. But I'm going to try my best to be able to challenge them as much as I can and really go as fast and add as much resistance as I possibly can to be able to prepare them.
And so let's go back to those forces. I think that the general population, unless you've been on a football field during a professional football game, you don't really understand
right.
the forces that are happening. The only way I can describe it is that you surely can watch NASCAR from your TV. And not that I'm a NASCAR fan. I don't get it. I just don't get it. But you can watch NASCAR from your TV, or you can be close to the track and feel the amount of power that's happening.
Right.
That's the same analogy that happens on a professional football field, is that when you see these massive human beings hitting each other,
right.
and you can literally feel those G-forces.
Mm-hmm.
And so in your experience, do you have any numbers? Do you know, I mean, how many, you talked about that they're experiencing car crashes on a daily basis,
mm-hmm.
20 mile an hour car crashes, 30 mile an hour car crashes?
You know, I don't honestly know. I wish I had a number for you, but I really don't know. But sometimes you see and hear these collisions and you wonder how they get up,
mm-hmm.
or you wonder how they're walking in, you know, the next morning, or how their body feels. And until you are up close and personal with those types of collisions, it's hard to appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, watching it on television is one thing, but once you see it up close and personal, it's really scary at times, mm-hmm. and you just kind of wonder, you know, if they're going to get up, and then sometimes they don't get up, you know. And so that's where we come in. But it can be scary, but it's part of the game, mm-hmm. and they have reached this level for a reason, and it's competitive out there. And so they're flying around everywhere, and we just try to manage it as best we can. And any guys that get injured or whatever, we try to patch them up and get them to the next game. So,
Jameer, you have any questions for Roland?
I do, actually. Apparently you are a PT, ATT?
Right. Yes, sir.
Credential.
Yes, sir.
I was wondering, what is the appeal of that for students like myself?
Right.
To go and get the DPT after we finish our master's degree.
Right. You know, I think that being dual credentialed it depends on where you want to go and what your ultimate goal is as far as the position that you want. I think that the higher the rank, as far as whether it's collegiate and serving as a rehabilitation coordinator, or at the pro level, or working with the Olympics or whatever, I think that as a student you have to focus on doing whatever you need to do to set yourself apart. Okay, so when you are, say you want, your goal is to, you know, work in the Olympics or work at a professional football or baseball setting, then you're going to compete against somebody else. And so all sorts of resumes are going to come across their desk, and the executives or head athletic trainer or whatever it may be, and it's going to be yours as an athletic trainer and this other person that's going to be dual credentialed. Okay, you're going to have to compete for that. And on paper, just alone, they're already surpassed you on paper, right? And so you're just going to have to go in. Hopefully you get an opportunity, but they might have 5, 6, 7 dual credential guys, and they're going to go after those if that's what they're looking for. Or if you come highly recommended as an athletic trainer, right, and you get a chance or a foot in the door to do an interview, then you know, so be it. Then that's awesome. But I think that you have to, if you can manage the time and the finances, you know, I think that it is well worth it depending on where you want to go. And so when I was facing that crossroads, I knew way back when in high school that I wanted to be a rehabilitation coordinator of either a Major League Baseball team or a football team. And so I did everything. There was no question for me that I was going to be dual certified. No question at all. And I didn't care what the finances were or how long it took me. That was the trend at the time. And as far as being in a position of this caliber, and I was working in a PT clinic, and I took a huge pay cut to take my first athletic training job in the NFL. But I knew my ultimate goal and what I wanted to do. So I tried to make sure that I put those pieces in place to give myself the best shot and the best chance at obtaining one of these positions. And so I think if you can afford it and if you're willing to go that extra mile, I think you need to set yourself apart. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. Thank you. I had one more question, but it kind of escaped me just now. So.
Yeah, sorry for the long-winded question or answer.
No, you're fine.
Yeah.
Something you grow accustomed to.
Yeah, but definitely, yeah. Definitely, you got to set yourself
apart.
That's
a knock on me, by
the
way.
Yeah, yeah.
Ask me a question, and then you wait for a 10-minute dissertation.
Right.
Well, all right. So let's go back a little bit and talk about, just as we kind of start to wrap some things up, what new trends are emerging when we talk about prevention, when mm-hmm. we talk about treatment, when we talk about rehabilitation?
Right.
What new trends are occurring? Obviously, everybody's watched professional sports.
Right.
And they, you know, whatever, especially in the United States, it's football.
Right.
And so what new things are on the horizon here?
Right. No, and you know, there are a few things. One is, I think the sports science aspect of things is really taking off. Mm-hmm. You know, whether that's throwing GPS units on them, on the players, and using catapult or different technology that measures their heart rate or maybe measures their readiness to perform or their sleep levels. There are all sorts of tools and instruments now that are emerging. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very interesting to see some of these numbers, and we're starting to implement Catapult ourselves. And so it's interesting to see.
And so for those that aren't familiar, there's some people who are listening. What's Catapult?
Well, Catapult is a device that is basically a GPS unit and has an accelerometer in it, can measure, you know, your overall load and your intensity and your acceleration and deceleration in certain, you know, with certain movements in mm-hmm. certain directions. And so it's very interesting to see how it measures the load and how you can compare certain positions or the velocity that certain positions or certain players are compared to others. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's it's some interesting data that is coming out with that, and that you're able to put behind what you see on the field.
And so we're adding evidence to this.
Right.
Is what we're seeing. We can't really explain it. Now we're taking some objective measures.
Right.
And we're engaging in evidence-based practice.
Exactly. And
through research.
Yeah. And that's what we're about, right? Yeah. How many times have you heard that?
Too many to count. You know, one of his mentors is Dr. Taylor at Texas Tech.
Okay.
There you go.
And Dr. Leslie Taylor, she is the incoming president for the Katie. So Dr. Merrick will serve one more year, and then Dr. Taylor will take over. And she is just an outstanding person.
She's awesome.
She is awesome. And boy, if you want to be able to compete off of what Roland said, depending on what setting you want to go to, if you want to be able to compete, he's right. You got to be able to set yourself apart. And what is going to make you different than everybody else? When I think Roland was coming through, it was probably, you know, dual credentialed or somebody that has a doctoral degree. When I was coming through, same, dual credentialed or somebody that has a doctoral degree. For me, a little bit further down the road, it was somebody who understood the business of athletic training education and accreditation and stuff like that. For you, you're a new generation. Just in the last few years, there's been more doctor of athletic training degrees. Your master of PT degrees have really gone to a DPT. By 2020, they'll all be DPT. By 2022, all athletic training will be all entry-level masters. You're going to see this huge population of doctor of athletic training degrees. You're going to see a huge population of more PhDs in athletic training focusing on sports science. So I think, personally, just making a prediction here, those people with a baccalaureate degree in PT, AT, it doesn't really matter. They'll be dinosaurs. They'll be obsolete. Those people with a master's degree, I think that you'll probably make up, 60%. Those people with doctoral degrees, duly credentialed, more training, that will make the other 40%. And it'll keep pushing. It'll keep growing. The more we learn, the more we know, the more we share. You also, Roland, brought up something, and I want to go back to Catapult.
Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then I want to kind of circle back around. You alluded to something that I'm a huge, huge supporter of: Institute of Medicine interprofessional collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be able to speak to other professionals. Nobody can function in silos.
Right.
And so that kind of alludes to what you're talking about in sports science, but we talked to you about, referring out to specialists, et cetera. So let's wrap up with, what Catapult provides you.
Right. As far as what Catapult provides and the collaboration, but even between levels of, I'm sure there are some high-end high schools that probably have it. That can afford it or use that technology. And then there's some colleges, and then there are professional levels, of course. And then you across different sports or soccer is a huge user of Catapult. Okay. Even in the basketball industry, I think they've used it quite a bit. And so the ability for us to, I'm a novice with this, and we're just learning about this. I'm definitely, this is not my background, and so I'm learning as we speak. But I think that you have to be open-minded about this stuff. I think that the data that it is showing, I think you have to be able to try your best to understand it and see what this is bringing, forward, and all the numbers that are being shown behind what you've always seen in a practice or in a game,
right?
And so I think you have to be open-minded to all this new technology. Some it seems a little far-fetched, and others don't. But I think you have to just kind of learn by trial and error and proceed on and see what kind of fits what you do as a whole as a sports medicine staff.
And as we switch over here to, ladies and gentlemen, this is Jeff Kaplan. I mean, to be in the presence of Cap, it's on. All you gotta do is speak, Cap. There you go.
Hey, Josh.
Hey.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, sure. No problem. How are you?
Good. It's an honor to be here.
Just talk briefly about the value that you bring to whatever table when you're able to present whoever's making decisions about your job,
mm-hmm.
or your longevity. Talk about the value you bring to the table when you've actually got this data in front of you and say, look, this is what we thought. Here's what it is.
Right, right. I think my personal value lies in all of the field rehab. And what you do in the training room is definitely important. It's vital to getting the athletes back. But the field rehab is the stuff, in my opinion, you don't learn in school.
Mm-hmm.
And never got it. I didn't have an athletic trainer in high school. And when I went through college, I didn't see much of it as well. And you hear from other athletes that come in the doors every year about athletes that never, you know, progressed with any kind of field rehab or return to sport or return to play criteria, mm-hmm. and were taken through position specific stuff. And so I think that that's where my value and passion lies. I love to be on the field. I love getting my hands dirty. I love to be able to challenge them out there and throw different position specific work at them. And so I think that the application of data like Catapult or other devices that can put numbers behind what I actually see physically, I think is important. Years ago in developing a return to sport assessment for our team was also another way for us to be able to, for me to be able to dig into the literature, see what kind of assessments are out there. Mm-hmm. Whether that be hop tests or any other agility tests, and then be able to apply those to our athletes to put numbers behind what I already see, mm-hmm. and be able to show our management and our, you know, maybe it's Jeff Kaplan, and show him the numbers that say, hey, this guy, he's ready. You know, he's ready to go. I've challenged him enough. He's running, cutting, twisting, no issues, no problems, and here are his numbers behind all the hop tests and agility tests, and then here's the Catapult that also shows that his load is comparable to maybe somebody else at his position. So I think that all of that tied in together into returning a player back onto the field, where in a lot of cases that part, that bridging of the gap is not performed and not done, and sometimes leads to re-injury or other injuries of our athletes. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's important. I think that and that's where my love and passion is. And so I think applying all that together is where my value sits.
Thank you, Roland. I hope you'll come and speak to our program.
Okay. Obviously. I'd love to. Anytime.
Yeah, good.
Anytime.
Are you busy during the fall or?
Yeah. We're going to have to wait until next year.
What?
But I would love to anytime. Sure.
Great. Great. And so we'll transition over to Jeff Kaplan.
All right.
BFR.
I mean, I've got to wait on Mr. Kaplan anyway, so I might as well.
Did you drive him?
Carpool.
I did.
Does he have a?
Chauffeur.
Really? You chauffeur him over, do you? Yeah. And so here we are with Jeff Kaplan, G-E-O-F-F, Kaplan. Jeff Kaplan. And so those that want to look up this episode, it's going to be thesportsmedicinebroadcast.com/Jeff Kaplan, G-E-O-F-F. 2016. And again, I'm Dr. Josh Yellen, University of Houston, Master of Athletic Training Program. To my left is Jameer Marina. He's a second year MAT student. You want to look up our website, www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. Jeff, let's talk about blood flow restriction.
And what do you want to talk about, Josh?
I want to talk about anything you want to talk about, Jeff.
So I think blood flow restriction is new to a lot of people. I think of it as cutting edge, but there's been research around for 20 or 30 years supporting it. It's just new. It's definitely new to us. It is definitely new to what I would consider mainstream athletic training, mainstream sports medicine, mainstream therapy, and has really exploded over the last year and a half. It started Veterans Day 2014. Stefania Bell did a really cool piece on it with Johnny Owens, based in San Antonio, Texas, at Brooke Army Medical Center, Center for Intrepid, how they were using BFR on our wounded athletes that have come back from Afghanistan and Iraq and wars overseas. And she exposed it to us January 2015. We got exposed to Johnny Owens. He came over to NRG Stadium, mm-hmm. and gave us a really cool in-service. So we've been using it since January 2015 with, I think, pretty cool success, and I think now I would guess that I know for a fact all three major sports teams in Houston have it, the Texans, the Astros, and the Rockets, and I think over half the NFL teams are using it now. Mm-hmm. Over the last year and a half, it has exploded.
So when I was a young faculty member at Southeastern Louisiana University, one of our graduate students did some blood flow restriction research, right, with one of our faculty. And if you looked it up, it would be, I think, Reeves, Kramer, and Hollander would be one of the articles that you looked up. And so they were just at that point kind of experimenting with different types of pressures that they would use in blood pressure cuffs, and, you know, how does this affect, and what enzymes are being released, what chemicals are being released, how does this affect hormones? And so what are some of the things that you're seeing, right, now that we've really gone from research to clinical application? You all are applying this, and tell me why you would use blood flow restriction, tell me why you wouldn't use blood flow restriction, and tell me some of the expected outcomes.
So I wouldn't use blood flow restriction if there was a contraindication, and there's about 10 to 15.
Can you name the top three?
Contraindications: open wound, diabetes, peripheral vascular disease, cancer.
Mm-hmm. Pregnancy.
Sickle cell. If you're sickle cell, not sickle cell trait, if you're sickle cell.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the top ones.
Okay. And so those are all my contraindications. What are my indications?
Anybody that needs to do rehab.
So that's it, right?
Pretty simple.
So like if I'm rehabbing from a calf strain, blood flow restriction.
So if you're rehabbing from a calf strain, do you have weakness?
Sure.
Do you have disuse atrophy?
Yes.
Are you trying to regain strength?
Yes.
Are you trying to regain function?
Yes.
Then yes. If you can answer yes to any of those questions, I think you use BFR.
So you'd be a good candidate for BFR.
Correct.
So let's move. This is why I love. That's why I love talking to Cap. You know. You never there's never a thought of, I wonder what he's saying. It's more like, uh-huh. Okay.
It's pretty direct.
Yeah, I mean, you would think.
I mean.
You would think.
Yes.
You know, the times that Cap and I communicate, I learned a really good lesson about how he communicates. The first time we started communicating about, you know, this partnership, I want to be as detailed as possible, and I'd outline some things, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Yes. That's how he'd respond. What time is better? You know, we do it at 2. I mean, that's the way he does. So
I have to multitask a lot at work and deal with a lot of different situations and people. So
and
I
so
be as quick.
Yeah. And, so you don't have time to deal with my antics.
No, I don't mind them. They're entertaining.
So let's go back and say, all right, we talked about soft tissue, right? Calf strain. What if I'm rehabbing from an ACL repair?
Exactly right. We're trying to retard atrophy. We're trying to increase strength. We're trying to mitigate any type of weakness that's going to happen because of immobilization, limited weight bearing status, anything like that. So BFR does all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And how about bone healing? We didn't talk about bone healing.
I was going to get there.
We're trying to research out now that BFR helps with bone healing, helps with increasing blood flow to the area via different changes in the hormones and the systemic effects mm-hmm. that go on. Also, increasing osteoblast proliferation in the area.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back and you know, for all those people that are listening to the broadcast, and they want us, you know, they're thinking about introducing BFR in their particular settings, et cetera. And obviously, it's one of those modalities that has this incredible benefit. Across,
I think the research is overwhelming. In the talk that I gave today, there's 110 articles in peer-reviewed journals
about BFR
that was cited.
And so, what are some of the things that, you know, when you apply BFR in your setting, what's your timeline? When do you introduce it? What are the expected outcomes? You know, because I think there are a lot of myths about BFR, right? And the one thing that I think that we do in our profession is that we tend to latch on to certain things. And, you know, this is the greatest thing since. But BFR has really got some reliability and validity to what it's doing. So
I agree with you, Josh. And one of my biggest jobs at work is to weed out the fads and really try to hone in on the things that are scientifically proven. There are a lot of fads that come across my desk. There's a lot of fads that come across the training room. Everybody wants pro football players to use the latest and greatest thing, even if it's not proven.
Mm-hmm.
When I was introduced to BFR a year and a half ago, the scientific research is overwhelming. Overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important to do it the right way. I think it's important to use the right devices. I think it's important to get the right training. So I think all those are key components into doing it the right way.
And so it's not just one of those things of like, you know, some of the settings, they'll bring on a BFR unit and, okay, let's see what happens. You got to go through specific training and understand the specific protocols.
So the company that we use our BFR devices, Delphi out of Canada, they will not sell it to anybody that's not been certified in one of their courses because they view it as a liability.
Sure, absolutely. And so when you apply the BFR, blood flow restriction, when you apply this BFR device, your expected outcomes are what? We're going to help accelerate through the inflammatory phase, fibroblastic phase, maturation remodeling phase. I mean, talk a little bit about that.
I don't think we're affecting the inflammatory phase very much. What we're trying to do is reduce atrophy, increase muscle mass, increase hypertrophy.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to bone healing, increase osteoblast formation, increase protein synthesis in the muscles. There's a systemic increase in mechanical growth factor. There's a systemic increase in IGF-1.
Mm-hmm.
There's a systemic increase in growth hormone. So there's a lot of systemic effects that happen from BFR.
And physiologically, how is it happening?
Should have came to my
question. I was
my lecture because
I was interviewing Roland.
I explained
in my defense
everything how it happens.
I was so if somebody wanted to find that presentation.
Well, I would tell you there's a couple good resources.
Okay.
OwensRecoveryScience.com.
Okay.
Johnny Owens out of San Antonio, Texas, has a website that has tons of BFR information on it. Has where you can take his course, where you can get educated on BFR,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I would recommend anyone to do.
Okay, and I'm sure Jeremy Jackson will probably be able to post, I think similar to what he's doing with
probably
Roland's presentation, be able to post
maybe.
It on Sports Medicine Broadcast so people can see it, right, and they can kind of review the literature, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
How has BFR changed your, I mean, obviously, if you need a rehab, BFR, fine. But how does that change your outcomes? So you're getting better patient outcomes.
So in our setting, it's very hard to measure that because we don't have a control group.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't take a guy that has had a meniscus repair on one side and use BFR and then do a meniscus repair on the other side with no BFR or compare one player to another player. One guy getting BFR from, a knee scope, and another guy getting no BFR from a knee scope. It's very hard for me to control that.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard for me to compare that. But I can tell you that most of our findings are anecdotal.
Mm-hmm.
We see guys going from partial weight bearing to full weight bearing very fast.
Mm-hmm.
We see guys that have incredible function and strength that is disproportionate to the number of weeks out from surgery there. Based on our past experience.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the best way.
Right. And I think another thing to note with BFR is the ability to get the same effects at high loads, but only working at 20 or 30% of those loads with the BFR or with the tourniquet applied. It creates this ischemic, hypoxic environment that essentially just tricks your brain and thinks that you have this incredible amount of load that you're trying to push. Say it's a shuttle leg press that, you know, it feels like you're pressing 100 pounds, but it might only be 20 pounds, but you're creating the same effect in the limb that you're working. And so I think it, from a rehab standpoint, the ability to create this environment and have all the benefits of BFR that Jeff just mentioned with working at a low load, especially in the rehab setting as they're progressing and it protects the joint and protects the surgical structures or whatever might be injured, the ability to perform and perform exercises at a lower load but still get the same effects as if it was a high load, I think is just incredible.
You know, there's a lot of research out that compares BFR to high-intensity training.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know the effects of high intensity training.
And you're talking about Tabata, you know, Dr. Tabata, or are you talking about just HIIT training in general?
Just HIIT training in general.
Okay.
And the effects of BFR are better using BFR than high intensity training.
And that can be found in the research.
That's correct. So you can't do high intensity training like Roland was saying after surgery.
Right.
You can't do high intensity training when you have an acute calf strain.
Right.
So how can we trick the body? How can we change the body to think that it's doing high intensity training? Decrease the load across the joint while you have healing structures, postoperatively, while there's a healing environment, physiological healing of the tissue, and that's what BFR does. That's the beauty of BFR.
That's a tagline right there. That's catchphrase, beauty of BFR. I want 10% of whatever you make off that. Jeremy, you're going to put up Jeff's, can you put up Jeff's presentation, the one that he did, or no? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so people will, and, you know, they can go to the sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, and they'll be able to pull down Jeff's presentation, because, I mean, really 110 articles.
And it's really quite overwhelming, the amount of peer-reviewed,
right,
good scientific articles.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
Available, supporting BFR.
And this has really changed your ability to practice.
Well, I think because the scientific research is so overwhelming, we as a staff have decided to implement it full force.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody going through a rehab program is using BFR in our training room.
Mm-hmm.
Why not?
Right.
The overwhelming support, the overwhelming evidence is too much to ignore. So I'm like, why not? It doesn't change the way we rehab at all.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't change the way we rehab. It's an adjunct to the way we rehab.
And so for all those that are listening, you brought up something beautiful. Do you ever implement protocols that you can't verify through research?
So Roland and I have been doing this a long time. And most of our protocols are our own protocols.
Sure, but
that we've kind of used over the years. We've taken doctors' protocols and their post-operative protocols and stuff like that, and we don't do a lot of research on our own.
Mm-hmm.
So we rely on the experts in the medical community to produce the research for us to read. We read a lot of journals. We go to courses, things like that. So all the stuff we do is scientifically based.
Right, and so that's my point, is that you're constantly, you know, growing your knowledge base. You're constantly consuming knowledge so that you're able to objectively look at, right, what's been proven, what hasn't, what's a fad, what's not, you know, based on anecdotal evidence because of your experience in the field, right? And we're going to combine all this. And as we move forward in evidence-based practice, I mean, this is a perfect example of, unfortunately, you know, we've all come across people that just take whatever it is and they throw it at the wall and see what's going to stick. That's not very effective. It's not going to, you know, produce good patient outcomes. Here's a perfect example of people that are really probably setting the stage for other people to follow, right? Everybody always wants to follow what the NFL is doing. You guys are some of the best I've ever seen in the industry. And you all are going through very systematically, learning as much as you can, consuming as much as you can, taking that evidence, taking that research, applying your own experience and saying, okay, this is what I think is going to work.
So during my talk, I was answering one of the questions, and I said that physical therapists and athletic trainers want to be considered elite healthcare professionals. That's what we want to be considered. So if we want to be considered elite healthcare professionals, why wouldn't we use rehab techniques that have tons of scientific literature backing them up, as opposed to other forms of blood flow restriction, which utilize different types of elastic bands and different things like that, where you don't know how much occlusion you are creating, how much pressure you're creating, how narrow the bands are. Why wouldn't you use the system in place or the techniques in place that have been proven by science?
Right.
And that are medically approved.
Right.
Because there are a lot of occlusion devices or cuffs that are not approved.
Not FDA approved.
Right.
Right.
And so you have to be careful with that. But, you know, going back on what Jeff was saying, we try to be as proactive as we can. We try to, read up and study evidence-based material and apply that with all of our athletes. We have to, our athletes are always trying to push to be the best, and we have to push to be our best when it comes to new technology or new techniques in trying to help our guys stay on the field or return to the field.
Sure. Well, Jameer, do you have any questions? And let me, you know, let me just say something about Cap over here. One of the best you'll come across. So he's sitting in front of you. You got any questions?
You want? Pretty much answered all of my questions. I actually waited all day to hear your talk, and I wound up missing it. I was in there helping out, but I'm glad I got a chance to just sit across the table from you. I listened very intently on everything that you said, and I really appreciate the opportunity to just be in the room right now. I don't have any questions at the moment, but trust me, when I ask questions, they come out. Dr. Yellen knows that.
Jeff, if somebody want to get in touch with you, what's the best way if they've got questions for you?
My email address is Jeff, G-E-O-F-F dot Kaplan, K-A-P-L-A-N at HoustonTexans.com.
And if they've got some questions for you, they can just shoot you an email and say, hey, you know, Cap, I got a question for you.
Yep, no problem.
Also on Twitter, man.
Yeah, and you got Twitter, a Twitter handle?
I don't do Twitter.
do you do Facebook?
No.
Snapchat? FaceTime and
Instagram?
Facebook?
FaceTime and Facebook.
No, I don't do any of that stuff.
You'll be able to see Jeff's the interview, and Jeremy will put up his presentation. Again, go to www.sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. Jeff, G-E-O-F-F, Kaplan, 2016. For the interview. If there are no more questions, I'm going to sign out. For the Sports Medicine Broadcast, it's nice to see Jeremy Jackson again. Dr. Josh Yellen, University of Houston, Master of Athletic Training Program. Look us up, www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT.